Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Clean Air Act is a more than 50-year-old federal law with a name that seems pretty straightforward. It allows the EPA to set standards to protect public health by regulating emissions of hazardous air pollutants. But while the intention may seem clear, to breathe clean air, the reality is murkier. An investigation by the California Newsroom found that a little-known provision in the Clean Air Act forgives pollution caused by natural or uncontrollable events, like wildfires. And this exceptional events rule is being used more and more by local air regulators, alongside the extreme events associated with climate change, which means the air might appear cleaner on paper than it actually is to breathe, and that has significant consequences to public health. Molly Peterson is an investigative reporter with the California Newsroom. That's a collaboration among public radio stations around the state and includes Cal Matters. And she joins us with more behind the findings, as well as what can be done differently. Good morning, Molly.
Good morning.
When did you start looking into this? What piqued your interest?
Well, I've been reporting on fires as long as I've been back in California. So that was after Katrina, and seeing the increase in the tempo and the scale of the fires was noticeable, but it was actually in the Central Valley, in the northern part of the valley. I was talking to regulators there a while ago, and that was the first time I heard the word exceptional events. It kind of stayed back there for a very long time. And then, you know, we've had just really brutal years, as Sacramento area knows, and the Sierra foothills know. And so we got interested in this again, I think, as a signal of kind of how well are we handling climate change and how well do our laws see and allow us to see the problem.
You have done extensive reporting. You have a series of four reports. Did you envision when you first started tackling this that it would span a series as extensive as what is published now?
I think it's a really obscure rule, and it's very, very well known to this small pocket of people, regulators and clean air activists. But it's not something that we saw a huge amount of public comment on. California uses the rule so much, and California in other states using the rule is blamed so much. And yet we don't see a lot of public comment on these filings. So we knew that we were going to have to go very carefully to explain this to people, because it's one of those ones that's very obscure and hidden kind of in plain sight. When this rule got changed by the Republican Senator Jim Inhofe, who is a climate denier, from Oklahoma, it wasn't even really considered a major revision of the Clean Air Act. But this is this little concept that's getting used more and more.
Well, let's get to that, because that happened in 2005, having this exceptional events rule. But the Clean Air Act goes back to 1970. So this is relatively a new provision that was added to this federal law. What was the original intention and argument for this?
Well, it's interesting, right? So when we started talking about having clean air laws in this country, it was in part because there were these terrible smog events. We saw them in London after the war. We saw them in the United States and in Southern California. What we were talking about were tailpipes and smokestacks. And so there's always been this idea that there's something beyond regulators' control. Former California Air Resources Board Chair Mary Nichols, when she worked for the EPA in the 90s, actually wrote up an informal policy that was like, listen, don't focus on the pollution from these wildfires. We can talk about that. Focus on, you know, clamping down on the things you actually can handle. But then this got put into law with even more kind of exceptions in it, not just wildfires, not just volcanoes, but also unusual traffic circumstances and fireworks. And so then the question became, how do we actually enforce this? How do we prove these events? And it's become this really, even the states that use it quite a bit complain about how burdensome and complicated it is. So it's this weird, obscure, burdensome, costly thing that makes a really important difference to a small number of regulators and states.
I mean, so just hearing you talk about it, it could even include like, you know, unusually high traffic events in addition to like wildfires or wind events, volcanoes. When I was reading your reporting, I mean, by forgiving pollution that's caused by natural or uncontrollable events, you know, I've covered a great deal of wildfires as well in California. And I thought that pollution also includes building materials, and that is controlled by the state, local codes, regulations. So aren't our practices contributing to extreme climate and weather events? I mean, a forest fire just alone in the forest is very different than a wildfire that destroys properties.
It's interesting, right, that the EPA, so this was litigated over in federal court, the exceptional events rule, in 2017 and 2018. And what's interesting is that the EPA was arguing that wildfires were natural at that time, which is a puzzler because I think what we know is that there's a combination of like 100 years of suppression. There's the climate change induced changes both to the landscape and to the atmosphere. And so we know there are lots of reasons why fires, and of course people start fires. So there's lots of reasons why fires happen that are not entirely natural. And I think it's even true for wind events. I mean, wind events pick up dust and carry dust. Dust is obviously, as you say, created by construction and also by development. So, you know, forgiving things that are out of our control just means that we're not paying attention to them and we're not going to hold anyone responsible for them or make any policies to take action on them.
So this is essentially like good air quality with an asterisk. You know, the data isn't really capturing what people are actually breathing. I mean, you took a canvas across the nation, but where does California stand in all of this?
Well, what's so interesting is there's nothing else in the Clean Air Act that changes data in this way. And, you know, there is the underlying what the official federal monitors there on our landscape. That data is still there. But there's nothing else that removes data from the regulatory record like this. And so what's interesting is that we found, so nationally, more than 21 million people live and breathe in areas where the attainment status for their region has been changed. And what was interesting about that was that it was not just, I mean, this happens in California for millions of people. It happened in Sacramento in 2012. It happened in Ventura, and it happens in a lot of rural areas, including Nevada County. It also happens in places like Louisiana. It happens in Michigan. It happens far away from where the fires start. And so, you know, scientists at Stanford University in the last couple of years have figured out that particulate matter and that ozone are on the rise in the Western United States because of wildfires. They're actually reversing the progress of the Clean Air Act. And nobody's saying that the EPA is supposed to have done all of this land management over these years. It's a complicated set of responsibilities. But it's interesting that the people we think of as being responsible for our health are not, in their minds, responsible for addressing wildfire smoke and thinking about it as a potential health risk.
And we have all experienced the impacts of wildfire smoke. You don't even have to live in California. Wildfires in California can spread across the country. Wildfires in Canada can go south to southern states in the country as well. You mentioned Nevada County and you mentioned the Sacramento Valley. When you talk to people on the public health side about what they're seeing about the health impacts of these loopholes in kind of not being able to gauge the real risk of the air that they're breathing.
You know, we talked about Nevada County in part because they've erased from the regulatory record 16 days of air pollution. But Nevada County is very familiar with the fact that wildfires are returning to its landscape, that smoke kind of sits. The regulator there, Julie Hunter, called it a kind of a pancake in that valley. And that there's pollution sources that come through the valley, you know, on the transit road where the trucks come. So, you know, it's a rural county with a very big problem, and they're doing everything they can to respond to it. And I was really impressed that Julie Hunter talked to us about this for this story, because it's a really difficult position to be in, to be aware of this wildfire smoke, to have personal consequences living in that area, and then also to have to figure out, you know, how to use all the regulatory tools. And so the state of California says it's going to continue. And this is the California Air Resources Board says that they're going to continue to use these tools.
Well, you did. Yeah, you spoke with the California Air Resources Board's chief of the Air Quality Planning and Science Division. His name is Michael Benjamin. So let's just get to it and play a part of your interview with him.
There's a disconnect between sort of the Byzantine intricacy of the Clean Air Act and then what people are experiencing on a daily basis in terms of what they're breathing. And so I think that is a huge challenge for us from a public messaging perspective, is how are we addressing it? So it may look like we're playing a game here and not truly trying to protect public health, but I would say we're trying to thread the needle in terms of really taking concrete actions to reduce air pollution from all sources, including wildfires. We're really trying everything we can, but we're also trying to play the bureaucratic game.
How did that deepen your understanding of just the complexities involved in this?
What's interesting about the exceptional events rule and the EPA is, you know, very clear that they want this communicated, is that there are mitigation plans that attempt to sort of respond to the impacts of wildfires, of fireworks, of dust events. In the Central Valley, the regulators in San Joaquin are, you know, burdened with all these extra mitigation plans in addition to the mitigation plans that they actually have. I think what's challenging about understanding that this is the response is that this is about public communication, you know, to this big problem that puts the responsibility on people to just know and manage their own risk about this. Asking people to just, you know, when you just warn people and say, oh, the wildfire is coming, then what are they're supposed to stay inside? They're supposed to not be outdoor workers. They're not supposed to be children who are playing outside. I mean, people have lives that are going to continue. Scientists in the Western United States who think about wildfire, who think about smoke, say, you know, we're going to have some element of smoke on the landscape. Denying that is the problem. And what we should do is think about how to manage that smoke to minimize impacts to people, which is a bigger question than any of these government responses currently address.
Yeah, as we know, there are health conditions connected to wildfire smoke in particulate matter. I mean, just from headaches to chronic health issues like asthma. When it comes to these exemption days, though, is there, what's to gain? What's the incentive behind, you know, applying and getting an exemption day?
Well, I mean, the main purpose is, and the EPA says this explicitly in its guidance, if you are on the line between attaining and not attaining federal clean air standards, this may help you retain kind of your clean air bill of health. And the reason you want to have that is because it minimizes your responsibility to regulate other things within your region. It lowers the kind of urgency of requirements that exist. And this is in part why this has only been used in mostly rural areas of California, as larger cities in California are dealing with so many other sources of pollution, that we aren't often on the line between meeting standards and not meeting. We're just not meeting standards. But in Detroit, earlier this year, they used it to have 3 years of clean air data and actually avoid having to do a vehicle registration kind of requirement, to have to do more rules that would have affected everything from, you know, auto assembly plants to print shops. So it's in the interest of chambers of commerce. It's in the interest of industry trade groups who advocate for their interests on this rule.
When you talk to people who aren't part of the industries or air regulators, they're just living in this and are concerned about the smoke, but don't, I guess, are learning that they're not getting necessarily always accurate information. Well, what do like everyday people tell you when you talk to them about this?
I mean, I remember very clearly one woman I spoke to who had lived in Santa Rosa and had, she and her family had evacuated from the fires, and thinks about the fire as something that, you know, that affects their entire community mentally and physically, and lived near firefighters and had neighbors who were in this fight, you know, moved her family from California during the pandemic, in part because the constant kind of concern about, should my kids grow up in an area where there's wildfire smoke, what, you know, hit her. And then she moved to Naperville, Illinois, and there, her child was playing soccer in the summertime. And she was asking the person running the activity, hey, is it safe for kids to be out here? And they had no idea. So this is kind of a scary new risk in other parts of the country. And so the fact that climate change is making it harder for people to understand how to do their daily activities and understand how to be safe, and that there maybe should be some more government guidance and activity on that, I think is a big part of the story.
At the core of this, it involves the EPA. And as you mentioned, the EPA doesn't manage land. So when it comes to solutions, what can actually be done to solve this problem?
I mean, I guess a few different things. Everybody sort of seems unhappy with the law, right? Even the regulators who have to file this, they spend millions of dollars on consultants. They spend a lot of hours of their own time trying to figure out how to use this escape hatch. It is possible to amend the Clean Air Act. And even where it is not possible to amend the Clean Air Act, there, it is possible to think about climate change and air quality as something that are related. And that's what California says it's doing. That won't get you all the way to solving the problem. The problem requires a real mind shift among people in government and people in the public, understanding that climate change is impacting our air quality right now. And that if we want government to do something more about it, people are gonna have to speak up about that and not just leave it to, you know, industry groups and to trade groups to have the most comment on it.
Finally, this can be, on the one hand, a defeating investigation to read. It can be demoralizing, but that's obviously not the goal of your reporting. You know, after everything that you've personally learned, I mean, what pieces of encouragement do you take from this to improve how, you know, we can actually strive for legitimately cleaner air and communicate the real risks with the public?
I think the most important moment that we can find is the moment where people can have a mind shift of their understanding and talk about it, right? I mean, I've been saying that this is the, at best, the third most frustrating news that anyone can read this week because of everything else that's going on. But it is fully within everybody's control who can hear this segment and read these stories to think about how climate change is affecting us a little bit differently. And ask questions about whose responsibility is it to keep our skies clear? And also whose responsibility is it to communicate to us the true nature of how clean our skies actually are?
Molly, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Molly Peterson is an investigative reporter with the California Newsroom, discussing her investigation into a little-known rule within the EPA that has become a loophole, letting air regulators wipe pollution from the record. You can find Molly's series of reports on our Cap Radio homepage. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Roadkill. It is unpleasant for many reasons, from the unsavory sight to the loss of life. But it can also can provide important information on the health of some of California's animal populations. From deer to mountain lions, the number of wild animals killed on California roadways can shed light on hot spots around the state that may be more dangerous for animals to cross, as well as what needs to be done to protect them. The problem is, while researchers say the information on where animals are being hit and the number of animals found killed is critical, there's really no formal way to track them all because much of the data collected is volunteer-based. CAP Radio's environment reporter, Manola Sakaida, spoke to researchers at UC Davis about what they've learned from roadkill and what the state is doing to better track and conserve native species. Good morning, Manola.
Good morning.
Okay, so on the topic of roadkill, what got you interested or even aware that there's research in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, obviously everyone sees roadkill, but it was interesting to me when I got this email about this roadkill report out of UC Davis's Road Ecology Center that was just really analyzing what that means. And that really was something I hadn't heard too much about before. You know, I've heard of measures to try to make it safer for animals around roadways, but not this kind of analysis. So honestly, it was kind of like morbid curiosity.
Yeah. I mean, and given that UC Davis has been tracking roadkill, kind of formally collecting data, how long has this been going on?
Right. So I guess for some zoomed out context, it was just interesting talking to a researcher at UC Davis, Fraser Schilling, who kind of leads that report, about when this started becoming a thing. And roadkill has been a thing since cars were invented, it seems like. Not really surprised there. One thing that Schilling, the researcher I talked to, told me was that there were some really early observations of roadkill that came out of California from this biologist, Joseph Grinnell, in the 20s. So, you know, really long time ago. And at the time, there wasn't really an approach to managing that in some way. It was just mostly observations that, hey, this is something that's really happening. And then maybe more recently, in the last couple decades, there have been more efforts to not just, you know, notice how we can try to address this problem, but see how roadkill can be a way of analyzing it as well. So the report that I was looking at, it's the 8th annual report from the Road Ecology Center, which is part of UC Davis, that analyzes roadkill from collections of data on it throughout the state. And the main thing that researchers discuss in the report are the declines or increases in the amount of roadkill for particular animals. So in this report, it said that there was a decline in road-killed mule deer and coyotes, and then there was an increase in road-killed mountain lions, as an example.
Mm. Okay, so this first started kind of being looked into more than a century ago in the 1920s, and now UC Davis is on its 8th report looking at this. What are they learning from roadkill on California's roadways?
Right. So one of the first points that Schilling made to me when we talked about this was that there really isn't a widespread understanding of just how impactful humans are when it comes to animals and possible population decline, specifically because of roads and cars. So in this report, it's noted that California doesn't keep population counts of most wildlife in the state, but tracking roadkill is a good way of maybe monitoring them, or at least giving a part of that picture. And from researchers are seeing, for some species, the rate of mortality is high enough to be concerning about how sustainable it is, that in the ways that we are, you know, accidentally killing them with cars. But zooming back out a little bit, roadkill can tell us a lot about the health of animal populations in California. And Schilling gave me his own explanation on how that works.
There has been recent research suggesting that if you keep traffic constant, the amount of roadkill is proportional to the size of the wildlife population. But there's two things going on there at the same time. Number one, the amount of roadkill is potentially indicating the size of the population. But if you have a lot of roadkill, you're also potentially decreasing the size of that population. So being able to understand that, one is an ecological measurement, and the other is a measurement of our impact, human impact on wildlife populations. So we want to be able to understand both at the same time. And that initial measurement of where the roadkill occurring, what species, when, and so on, is key to answering those questions.
So like he said, there's that first part about what does this tell us about the health of animal populations in the state? And then there's that other part, which is looking at the fact that humans driving cars are one of the biggest threats to some animal populations in the state. And there's ways to mitigate that, which Schilling talked about in the report when it comes to transportation infrastructure, adding more protective measures. And yeah, that was just the two big pillars of this report.
You know, and when you look at what the research shows, you make a point in your reporting to separate two of those key points about roadkill. So let's start with one of them. What does the amount of roadkill potentially indicate?
And that was a really interesting thing for me, too. Schilling told me that, for example, a decline in roadkill of an animal does not always necessarily mean a good thing. So he told me that, as an example, the decline in mule deer is something that might be occurring because of a declining population of the deer as a whole.
In the case of deer, we're seeing a decline in roadkill of deer. And so what that means to us is that because deer are moving around eating and they're generally staying inside home ranges, or in the case of a few herds, they migrate, the number that are killed is proportional to the number of deer that are total, unless you change how much traffic there is. Traffic has flattened during the pandemic, so it's not going up the way it was before. It went down and then it came back up a little bit. So traffic's not really changing. So if you see a change in the number of roadkill deer, it means there's a change in the population. And we're seeing a 10% per year decline in the number of roadkill deer. And the most likely explanation is that it's because there's a decline in the population.
So you can see by the way he describes that, that we can conclude that the decline is a negative thing because of everything else we know about how mule deer operate. But then, you know, aside from the deer, there's the fact that road-killed mountain lions are on the rise, and that means a different thing entirely, and it's actually kind of linked to that. Schilling told me that some of the researchers that he's talked to have guessed that it might be because of the way that mountain lion depend on these deer.
And if we've got a decline in the deer and mountain lion prey on deer, that means there's fewer deer for them to find, so they have to move around more to find those. And a lion moving around more means it's going to cross more roads and they're going to get hit more often. So deer road kills going down indicates a decline in the mule deer population. The number of mountain lion road kills going up indicates that sort of desperate search for food because there's fewer deer to find.
So to answer your original question, it seems like it kind of depends, you know, an increase or a decline in road killing of a certain species can mean different things depending on what we know about how they operate and how they're connected to other species. And these are just two prominent examples in this report on how that can manifest.
Yeah, there's a balance at play and we're all interconnected, you know, from humans to wild and native species. And that's what he was illustrating. When it comes to California, it's a very big state. Does UC Davis have a better understanding if there's hot spots in California or even in the Sacramento area?
Yes, there are hot spots that were highlighted in the report in California. And it's really important to know what those are so we can identify solutions based on those places, is what he told me. Schilling told me that most roadkill happens kind of around here. So it's the Bay Area through Sacramento into the foothills and the Tahoe area. And the reason for that is, you know, makes sense once you think about it, which is we have these big wildlife areas, some protected areas that are right next to super big urban areas. So it's basically where, you know, the forest meets really busy roadways. And that can be a recipe for, unfortunately, roadkill.
Yeah, like a wildland urban interface area or like a wooey zone, as they're known.
Exactly.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida about what roadkill can tell us about the health of California's animal populations. So you also did more extensive reporting on California's mountain lion populations. What did you learn?
Yeah, it was interesting because the roadkill story was kind of linked to that one. You know, as we already mentioned, the roadkill report can tell us that mountain lions are being impacted by roadways. And when they're forced to roam and cross roadways, that can lead to their death. But if they stay where they are and don't move around as they naturally would, that can lead to something else that's also pretty bad, which is inbreeding, and something that researchers have seen in mountain lion populations in Southern California. And the short of that is that inbreeding causes all sorts of issues for animals, especially when it comes to reproducing. So it's something researchers are worried about when it comes to mountain lion health. And it's an impact that's directly tied to human activity, the way that we build roads. Basically, what's happening is that these mountain lions are getting boxed in by roadways. They can't cross them, so they stay where they are. And that is how inbreeding happens. Schilling told me that one thing that's difficult about monitoring their health is that we don't have an accurate population estimate, or we didn't, of mountain lions in California, which makes it hard to understand, you know, if we're seeing a big decrease or increase in their populations. But last week, I spoke with carnivore biologist Justin Dillinger, and he is part of the team and led the team that came up with this new estimate. And that estimate for the population of mountain lions in California is about 4,500. So the range was 3,900 to 5,300, with 4,500 being squarely in the middle.
Okay, that's interesting, because that seems kind of recent. Why haven't we had an idea of their population numbers before?
There's a lot of reasons for that. We don't have population counts for a lot of species in California, which can be make things difficult, especially when it comes to keeping them safe or just knowing how they're doing. For mountain lions in particular, you know, there's so much interest in them. So I think that's partially why some researchers were also kind of wanting this information so that they could even just talk to the people that are asking them these questions. The last estimate was made in the 80s. So, you know, if you Google what the estimate is, you'll find one. And that is based off of this really rough estimate that was made in the 80s. Dillinger, the carnivore biologist I talked to, kind of described it as a back of the napkin approach. It was based off of a lot of assumptions. And, you know, that's not always completely the fault of the researchers at the time. Dillinger told me that he had to use a whole bunch of tactics to find this number that weren't always available. So, for example, he was able to genetically analyze mountain lion scat that he collected across their home ranges. And then they've also been able to put tracking collars on some of them, which is also kind of a newer development. And then what makes this even more complicated is that mountain lion rangers are huge. They don't just stick to one area, which is what Dillinger described that to me.
The thing that people just have a hard time comprehending is the spatial scale that they live life at. You know, for some of us, it might be our 10 to 20 square block area that involves our house, the gas station, the grocery store, and friends and stuff. And that's a small area. But mountain lions, it is just orders of magnitude bigger than what people, the scale at which people live their life at.
And then the other tricky part is that you can't just do this once. If you want this number to really mean something, you have to track it over time. And that way you can draw out some conclusions.
You can't just do this once and say we're all good. Ideally, this serves as a baseline and say every 5 to 10 years, you update it so that you can look at things like the trend in the population. Is it stable? Is it increasing, decreasing? This was a huge effort, but in my opinion, it's the first step in really beginning to understand lions across the state.
And all of that just takes a lot of time and effort.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a game changer for people who are vested in monitoring mountain lion populations.
Yeah, definitely. And it's important not just so that we understand, you know, population number, but it also helps us, you know, do something about it. So do something about where we take action for mountain lions. One thing, you know, researchers like Justin were concerned about was the density estimates. So, you know, how many mountain lions are in a certain area for mountain lions in Southern California, you know, who are being impacted by inbreeding versus Northern California. So even though we don't have a lot of numbers to compare this first one to just yet, he actually told me that it's already been somewhat helpful because he was comparing the Northern California numbers to Southern and actually saw that they were pretty similar. So that concern that maybe it's gotten to the point of, you know, huge decline, it seems like we haven't gotten there just yet.
We do have just a little bit of time. Now, that doesn't mean we put it on the back burner and don't get back around to it until a few years. We still need to actively be working to restore connectivity in Southern California right now. But the densities and survival rates and things like that are showing us that the lions they do have some time.
And I asked him about, you know, is there an ideal number? And he kind of told me that's not really the greatest way to look at it. So this number is a good thing. It can tell us a little bit that at least we're not seeing dwindling numbers in Southern California. But at the same time, a number doesn't tell us what the health of a population is like, you know, how they're thriving and surviving. So there is other information we need, but at the very least, it can tell us numerically that we're doing okay.
Yeah, it's like a snapshot in mm-hmm. time, but you don't know if that snapshot's going to change if there's inbreeding and they can't have, you know, baby mountain lions. That's yeah, going to exactly. affect, you know, future generations of mountain lions in the state. When it comes to prevention, what can be done to prevent roadkill from just happening in the first place?
So there's a few pieces to this. Schilling, the researcher with the Road Ecology Center, told me that there is a lot that can happen right now. The first things that came to his mind was trying to add some structures to roadways that already exist. So, for example, I know that wildlife bridges are something that people talk about, so ways that animals can cross safely. And then there's also, he said, something as simple as fencing along roadways. So preventing animals from crossing in areas that are the most dangerous would be really helpful. And he told me that last year, or in the last year, the legislature approved about $1 billion of funds to plan for wildlife crossings and fencing throughout the state. So that's really important. But another just as important thing is it needs to be done thoughtfully. And that's kind of where some of the issues arise, that sometimes the places where maybe transportation officials want to put a bridge or a fencing because it's, you know, maybe a convenient spot is maybe not the most effective for the animals. You know, we need to be placing them in spots where animals are actually impacted or actually are trying to cross the road. So there's that tricky balance there. And that's kind of part of the ongoing issue with addressing this. And then I know that on an individual level, I know at least that I kind of wondered, is there anything I can do about this? And from the report that I was looking at, it seems like the general advice is, you know, if you're driving through a wildlife area, drive a little bit more slowly, be cautious, be aware of those signs, you know, those deer crossing signs you'll see sometimes. Driving at night can be a bit more dangerous for the, you know, for this happening. And then there was the recommendation that, you know, try to drive less overall. But the part about that is that, you know, a lot of people aren't trying to drive through wildlife areas at night. It's not always a decision that you can really, you know, stay away from. So I do think that from what researchers told me, a lot of the big solutions are going to have to come from the state and building that infrastructure.
Given that California is so big and you have, yes, you have the state transportation officials, but then local jurisdictions, is it realistic to even have an accurate number of how many roadkill incidents there are in the state?
I don't know if we can say this is, you know, the perfect number or the perfect number of reports, but there is actually a way that people can get involved with helping. Schilling told me that in 2009, researchers launched this tool called the California Roadkill Observation System. So CROSS, which is, you know, kind of funny. You can find that on Google by either searching that name, California Roadkill Observation System, or even just Googling California Roadkill. I don't know if that's because my Google is skewed after doing this story, but I was able to find it just by Googling that. And there's a website where you can upload photos that you take of roadkill just on your phone. And, you know, it asks you a few questions that you can skip if you don't know, like, for example, what kind of animal is this? And those are just little ways in which researchers like Schilling collect this data. And he told me that volunteers are actually hugely impactful for this research. He told me about one volunteer in particular who did this for years and made a really big positive dent in the research by adding all this information. But of course, the flip side of that is that this is a volunteer system. A lot of people that are putting in information are people like you and me, but also a lot of researchers. But it's not paid in any way, and there's no mechanism to kind of fund it. So one thing that Schilling told me he'd really like to see is funding for a system like this one, not just to keep it running and keep people putting data in on a more consistent level, because, you know, consistency is really important, but also a guarantee that having this data means we're going to do something about it. So anyways, again, there is a way that people can participate, but I think Schilling really wants it to be a little bit more consistent.
In the last 30 seconds that we have, I mean, Manola, you did a deep dive into this and you did more than one report on this. What's your big takeaway?
It's kind of a bummer takeaway, but the big one is that we really underestimate just how big of an impact us driving in cars has on wildlife. It has a huge impact. And for some animals, it's one of the, you know, one of the worst things that can happen to their population. But with that information, I really hope that you know, for myself and others, we can see that we can recognize the impact and then also just try to see how we can advocate for solutions and be part of just kind of thinking about it and being aware of it and, you know, yeah, recognizing the part that we play.
Manola, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Manola Sakaira is Cap Radio's environment reporter, sharing her reporting on UC Davis conducting research into roadkill across the state to better understand animal populations across California with a goal to conserve native species. You're listening to and learning on Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's fall. The days are getting shorter, hopefully a little cooler. Daylight savings time will end and holidays like Halloween are just around the corner. And it's also the time of year when California's mountainsides turn into a carpet of reds, oranges, yellows, and browns. But for fans of fall foliage looking to enjoy the display, where should you go? When is the best time? And what's the best way to capture those brilliant autumn colors? To answer all of those questions, we welcome Kyle James. He's a professional photographer located in the foothills of Northern California with a peak location for leaf spotters. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Vicky. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. You take some stunning, beautiful photos, and particularly on the topic of fall foliage, leaf season. I would love to just start, like, what got you into photography and capturing all of this?
Certainly, yeah. Well, I got my start, my career started in doing photography for a newspaper back in 20, 25 years ago. It was the Union newspaper in Grass Valley, where I'm from. I kind of shadowed along with the photographer there and kind of got to learn how photography's done, the whole idea of it and processing film and whatnot. And just really took a liking to the idea of capturing what I saw through film, and eventually, of course, moving to digital cameras as well. But yeah, that's more or less how I got my start in capturing the beauty. Yeah.
Nice. Given that you're from the foothills, you're from Nevada County. You also worked for the paper. Years ago, in Grass Valley, and now you're still
right
there. What makes it such a great, beautiful place for leaf spotting?
So what's great about the foothills is during the gold rush, a lot of these deciduous trees that we see in the area were imported in from the miners, as well as a bunch of other folks as well, that wanted to kind of more or less, the settlers as well, wanted to more or less bring in a piece of their home. And with that, they brought a lot of seedlings along with them from the East Coast. And so today we've got a lot of trees, maples, a variety of different gorgeous trees that turn colors in the fall. So they kind of helped establish what we see now. And for the most part, a lot of these trees are big and beautiful and mature. And they're kind of scattered throughout the foothills here in Grass Valley, Nevada City. So it's a gorgeous area, especially during the fall. It's often considered, what I've heard is in comparison to, on a much smaller scale, kind of the East Coast of of our color, that being here within Western Nevada County. We've got some wonderful, wonderful color.
Yeah, a smaller, more intimate level with a lot of charm, you know, because Nevada City and Grass Valley are really charming places to live in.
Very much so.
And also to visit. Yeah. So is it true that you have to wait for like a cold snap before like the leaves start changing? When is a good time to go to see the peak of leaf season?
Sure. So right now is actually, we're approaching peak. Typically peak for the season here within Grass Valley, Nevada City area is somewhere around Halloween. But right now we're experiencing some early good color. I would say in about a week or so, we probably near prime as far as color goes. And what's nice is the color lasts into early November. So you've got a few more weeks of color here. Along with that, we've got the beautiful downtowns of both Grass Valley, Nevada City, Auburn as well. A lot of these areas are kind of sprinkled throughout with these gorgeous fall color trees. And again, you've got that historic backdrop of these downtown areas of Grass Valley, Nevada City, kind of that historic charm that go along with these incredible trees that are just so photogenic, if you will.
Does it vary from year to year, depending on, you know, the winter season, or is it pretty much you can come to expect it around this time every single year, and it's the same level of vibrancy?
Yeah, in my 25 years of kind of capturing the area here, I've noticed for the most part, it's pretty consistent as far as color goes and when it tends to change. We see in the upper elevations, like the Eastern Sierra, typically their colors will change around early October. But as you move into the lower elevations, we're say 2,500 feet, the colors here are pretty much consistent throughout the years. And that's being, you know, mid-October through late October is kind of really when you'll see the prime colors for these foothill areas.
You also have a fall color map, and that's around Nevada City. You make it very easy for people to take in the best spots of the fall colors. Is there a certain time of day if someone wants to take a really good photo? What kind of tips do you have for them?
Yeah, so what's nice about the taking photos here within the area of Grass Valley, Nevada City, really any time of day is awesome for photography because the sun doesn't rise as high in the sky. And with that said, you're not getting these kind of tremendous shadows that you see kind of earlier in the summertime where the sun is right above you and it's hot. But with the sun not rising as high, you're going to get better photos with the fall color. Oftentimes, I like to kind of wait more towards, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon is kind of when you'll see some beautiful color with the sun kind of coming down just a bit. And a lot of times it'll backlight these leaves that you see in the trees. And you can just capture some really, really terrific scenes with the sun kind of dropping in the sky. And it just makes for a beautiful backdrop. And, you know, midday as well, you're going to see some, you know, with blue skies set against the oranges and the yellows, it just makes for a really stunning scene as far as colors go.
Yeah. Okay, so this next question might be a faux pas for a professional photographer like yourself, but do you need a camera? Can you use a smartphone?
Yeah, what I oftentimes say to, because I've been hosting photo walks for a few years now here in the area, and oftentimes what I'll say to folks is, you know, a lot of people don't have these fancy DSLR cameras or mirrorless cameras or whatever it may be, but what I say to them, the camera that works best is the one that works, that you're carrying with you. And oftentimes that's your phone. So yeah, with today's technology and the clarity of these phones and the sensors and whatnot that they have built into them, you can capture some really, really fantastic photographs with just your phone alone. So there's really no need, unless you want to step up your game and purchase a more expensive camera. Certainly that's an option, but I think the best way to get started is with the camera that you have, and that being your phone.
Why do you keep doing it year after year after year?
I am just driven by the beauty of God's nature and color around us. I think it's something that brings me out every year. I love hiking around our local trails here. There's just so much incredible beauty within the area. We've got places like the Yuba River, with Bridgeport, which is the longest spanning covered bridge this side east of the Tennessee River, I think, or I'm sorry, the Mississippi River. There's Empire Mine in Grass Valley, which is incredible. It's got a bunch of old historic buildings. That's within Grass Valley. We've got Sutter's Mill in Coloma, which is beautiful as well. A lot of these places, you don't necessarily, if you're not into hiking, you can more or less kind of park and walk. But there are plenty of hiking trails in and around the area. I mean, we've literally probably have thousands of miles of hiking trails that you can hike. But if hiking is not your thing, there's plenty of park and walk sites available. Malakoff Diggins, North Bloomfield town site, which is another wonderful, wonderful area for seeing some fall color. That's a park and not much hiking involved with that one as well. They have some beautiful, beautiful color up on the North Bloomfield town site there in Malakoff Diggins.
Well, thank you so much, Kyle, for keeping it up and sharing it with all of us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Kyle James is a professional photographer who's captured the fall foliage colors in the Northern California foothills. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.